For the last look in this present series of looks into Old Testament characters, where many of us are reading, I want to look at King Solomon. We've chosen cases from Abraham's time down to the kingdom itself, and that gets ahead of our reading considerably. Solomon is third king of Israel. During his day, the promises God made to Abraham in a political sense, an economic sense, have been fulfilled. David has reigned from all the land, over all the land from the Euphrates down to the coasts of Egypt. Solomon inherits that kingdom and is easily the most powerful man in the Middle East in his day. With the glory, the peace, the power that he's been bequeathed, he enters upon a reign that would seem to be unique for its glory, but it doesn't end that way. He starts brilliantly, closes rather shamefully, shows a lot of wisdom at the first, and unfortunately a lot of foolishness at the last. If you think about it, Solomon marks the end of an era in Israel's history in lots of ways. Prior to this time, people who've been chosen to be kings have been great warriors, as in David's case, or outstanding for their stature, as in Saul's case, or for their spiritual leadership, as in the case of several of the judges. But Solomon is chosen because he's a man's son. He marks the perpetuation of a dynasty rather than the selection of a hero. He doesn't go out to battle. He doesn't reach out for the progress of his kingdom in the various ways his predecessors had. He stays in the city of Jerusalem and builds. He doesn't allow the temple of God, or the tabernacle, to house the Ark of the Covenant of God. Instead, he builds a temple, a permanent place for God's presence to dwell in. He establishes the 12 tribes throughout Israel, not just as geographical areas or as tribal groups who live together, but as areas for taxation purposes, for conscription, to enlist forced labor. And you'll find in reading Solomon's life in 1 Kings and in the Chronicles that one district would provide for his table 1 month and another district for another month and so on. So that Solomon uses this organization to tax the people and to perpetuate the glory of the center of the kingdom. He's a mixed person. So much good in him that we admire him, especially at the early part of his life. So much weakness in him that we feel sorry for him, particularly at the closing part of his life. To get an insight into Solomon, we have to start at the beginning when he has a rather brilliant beginning as king. He must have been around 20 years old when he became king. His father David is lying at the point of death. He's suffering chills. A young lady is brought. Every attempt is made. They try to get the older king to have his body heat restored, to have some possibility of returning to life. Nothing will work. Adonijah, one of David's sons, hears about it and decides it's time for me to announce myself as king. And he goes to En-Rogel, one of the two sources of water in the city of Jerusalem, a gathering place for people. And he takes with him Joab, David's strong man, and Abiathar, one of the priests, and announces, I'm going to be king. And he has 50 young men in their chariots riding with him. And the people of Israel begin to gather, the people of Jerusalem, around En-Rogel. Nathan the prophet hears about it, tells Bathsheba, mother of Solomon, didn't the king promise the kingdom to your son? Do you know what Adonijah is doing? It's best for you to go in and talk to the king. And while you're talking to him and telling him he promised the kingdom to Solomon, I will come in and join you and reinforce what you said. Bathsheba goes in to the elderly king, tells him her story. Nathan comes in. King David sends his own mule with Solomon to ride it down to Gihon, the other spring in Jerusalem, another gathering place of the people. And there with Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet, Solomon is proclaimed king. But all of that picture indicates that Solomon became king not by choice of the elders of Israel or the choice of the elders of Judah, not because he was a hero like Gideon or Saul or David, but because a dying king put the finger on him and said, he's the one who's going to be the king. And yet, Solomon begins with a brilliant stroke. He goes out to Gibeon, a few miles outside Jerusalem, and offers 1,000 sacrifices to God. And as he's sleeping at night, God appears to him in a vision and says, Solomon, ask anything and I'll give it to you. And in the dream, Solomon says, I'm just a child. I don't know how to go in, how to go out. I don't know how to lead these people of yours. There's so many of them, I can't number them. I'm not up to this task. Give me wisdom. That's foundational. If a person begins with wisdom, then power and wealth and other things can come. But if he begins with power and wealth, he may never gain wisdom. And God was pleased that Solomon made such a request. He said, because you didn't ask for power or to make your name great or for wealth, I'll give you what you asked. There's never been anyone before you with your wisdom, and there'll never be anyone like you with wisdom like yours. Solomon awakened, realized it was a dream, but also realized that God made a commitment to him and that he's going to rule God's people with a wise leadership, that he has that capacity now. That's so striking. You know how it happens in most of our lives. When we're adolescents, we want our freedom. As young persons, we tear loose from everything and we insist we're going our own way. We make a mess of our lives in many instances, and after we are broken with some crisis, then we decide we've been going the wrong direction, we need wisdom, and we go to God and ask for wisdom. Outstanding thing about Solomon is that in the very earliest part of his life, he asks for that wisdom and God was pleased. He didn't have to be begged. As James says, if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and doesn't upbraid. He doesn't criticize us for coming with a request. So Solomon asked, gained his wisdom, and his whole self-understanding would appear to be such that he's going to be a great king for Israel. Something else is remarkable about Solomon. Not only his understanding of himself, but his understanding of the past and his relationship to it and to the future. Solomon knew that his father David had gathered materials for a temple, but he had never been allowed to build it. God had said, you've been a man of war, you'll not build a house of worship to me. But David gathered materials that in our money would cost millions of dollars. Solomon comes to the throne, spends the first 7 years of his kingship building that temple that his father had gathered the materials for. Now, again, this is a wise thing. A young man is beginning brilliantly. So often we consider that we're sort of an island to ourselves. We can do what we very well please. We're self-made as young people. We have the strength. We can go out where we want. And we insist on going our own way. But Solomon realizes that he has a debt to the past. Especially in the 1970s, we heard a lot about a severe generation gap. Lots of young people in our country insisted that even if it tore the fabric of our nation apart, they were going their own ways. They had their own values. There was a just rejection of a certain headlong materialism in our culture. At the same time, a divisive sentiment that finally led to some tragic incidents. And today we seem to have moved back to the point that the generation gap is not quite so sharp or so pronounced. But it's an unusual person who realizes at the age of 20, when he comes to the throne of a nation, as Solomon did, that I have a great debt. And I'm going to take what my father's left and build what he dreamed about, and I'm going to prepare for the future. But that's Solomon's wisdom. If we had that kind of transition from one generation to another constantly, the world could be a better place, a stronger place. Solomon begins life as beautifully as one could expect anyone to. Self-understanding, understanding of his relationship to the past, his responsibility to the future. What happens? Solomon certainly does not wind up that way. If you know the story of 1 Kings 1 through 11, you know that in 1 Kings 11, verse 4, we're told that when he was old, his heart turned after other gods and was not true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. When he was old, what happened to Solomon? Well, we have to figure it out from the text. But I would judge that what happened to Solomon was that he didn't realize that life is a continual development all the way from birth to the grave. That we never reach a plateau where we can stop and say, it's done, I've succeeded, I don't have to worry about things from here on in. The psychologist Erik Erikson has spent a great deal of time insisting that all of life is made up of a series of stages. More recently, a series of books have told us about the passages through which we go. But Erickson insists that every stage has to be met with a new determination, a new transition, that it has to be negotiated carefully, otherwise life becomes a failure. Solomon evidently forgets this. You know how it is, the early stages in life's development are pretty clearly laid out. You have to find yourself as a young lady or a young man. What am I going to be? What am I going to do? What will my major be in school? What direction shall I head my life into? Then the transition comes to your education itself. And that advanced education is accumulated in the direction you've chosen. Then a new transition into your vocation. That first job responsibility. And the crises are laid out in pretty clearly perceptible order. When a person reaches 40, however, in our culture, he has often attained, or she has often attained, everything dreamed of in earlier years. We've already succeeded beyond anything we had hoped. The opportunities have been so great. Then instead of facing new crises and going on with new development and growth, many of us turn away from our maker into other directions and do not continue the development that was begun so well. That's exactly what happened to Solomon. Somewhere along the line, at the age of 40 or 50, Solomon decided it was all done. That he had accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. He didn't consider each challenge carefully, and he failed the test. That's a frightening thing. If a person can begin at 20 as gloriously as Solomon did, and then lose the game of life in the last quarter, it's quite a reminder of what Paul said once. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. We're never secure. There's never a time when we can stop the development toward our Maker. Stop the development toward greater service to our fellow man. And with all his wisdom, Solomon lost that perception. Can you trace in Solomon's life what made him lose that insight? I think you can. And if I had to sum up the reason he lost the insight in one word, the word would be affluence. And that's frightening. Was any people ever so affluent as we are? Solomon, when you read the story of his life, had gold flowing into Jerusalem by the tons. He made a covenant with Hiram, king of Tyre, got the cedars of Lebanon. He had riches, silver lay like rocks for abundance in the city of Jerusalem. Riches on every hand. You get a clue into what's happening to Solomon when you learn that after he spent 7 years building the temple of God, he spent 13 years building a palace for himself. And the house of the forest of Lebanon was larger in its dimensions than was the temple of God. So elaborately laid out. At some point in his life, Solomon became interested in buildings for building's sake. Not because of a way to serve God and man, but apparently for prestige, for the fact that he's a great builder. When you look at Ecclesiastes, there's so many warnings about this very kind of thing. When goods are increased, they're increased that eat them. And what good is there except the beholding of them to the owner's eyes? There's a sore evil I've seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners thereof to their own hurt. Warning after warning like this. That famous proverb, train up a child the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. But what Solomon does to that in his own life. As life goes by, he forgets. He attaches himself to his wealth. He doesn't continue in what he's been taught as a youth. For some reason, something deep inside him dies. Now, I think you can get clues to that. Early in his kingship, two harlots came to him one day with an unusual problem. They lived together in one house. Each had had a baby about 3 days apart. One of the mothers had overlaid her child during the night, and the child had died. She'd gotten up, exchanged babies with the other mother because it was a glory to have a child in those days. The other mother awakened to find a dead baby beside her, but when she beheld it in the light, knew it wasn't hers. And so the two ladies went for a judge and finally found themselves before the king. And after they had wrangled for a time over the living baby, the king said, bring me a sword. And when the sword was brought, he said, cut the baby in two, give half to each mother. The wrong mother, the false mother, the one who was making the wrong claim, said, that's good, cut the baby in half, I'll take my part. The true mother said, no, don't harm the baby, give it to her. Better that the baby live and for me not to have it than that the baby should be killed. Solomon said, she's the mother, the one who's willing to have the baby live even though she doesn't have it. Everything about that indicates a man who has a deep sensitivity to people. A man who's concerned for persons, a baby, a mother. Later in Solomon's life, the indications we have are that that is part of what has died. You read in the Chronicles that Solomon put under forced labor. He enslaved 153,000 men, first foreigners, then Israelites. The king who proposed to cut the baby in two with a sword is now cutting men in two, literally, by putting them in bondage, in slavery, to carry out his building projects, to build the grandeur of his kingdom. He has started out with such a personal interest, such a sensitivity, but he ends life treating people like things and without that personal interest. You and I have no greater danger than that we should fall victim to affluence. We all have a great deal. We have more than we need, and yet no one of us has everything he wants. We're going for more. When you think about it, you aren't quite sure why. You don't really need more, but there's just a built-in accumulation. It's the thing to do. There's greater security. There's greater pleasure, or whatever. Until eventually, other things begin to die, and that one thing stays alive, and we go for more and more. If you can enjoy unbroken affluence and forget about the fact that there are children who are dying because they don't have anything. If we can enjoy the accumulation of more and forget the needs that are all around us, we're facing Solomon's danger. The mechanics for bringing things needed to the people who need them are difficult. They always have been, they always will be. But it's the sensitivity that has to remain alive so that the efforts will continue to go forward. And Solomon lost that sensitivity. He began beautifully, he ended terribly. Building temples to all kinds of gods, following his foreign wives, worshiping through idolatry, everything around him had become an idol in a sense. Persons were no longer important. Things were important. The real test for ourselves is not easy to administer or to be honest with. But when the test comes, will you sacrifice things for persons or will you sacrifice persons for things? What the Bible tells us is that we worship a Father, a God who is a Father, and that in a personal heaven, there's really no place for a being who has become a thing. For a being who has become so set on things that he lost that personal dimension, that personal concern and interest. When you look at Solomon's life and you remember, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall, it becomes a frightening life. Because if it happened to him in the last quarter, it could happen to us. It could be in process of gradual happening. That's why Solomon's life of wisdom and folly is a necessary life for us to look into if we're going to know our ancestry, if we're going to realize our problems, see ourselves through biblical characters, and avoid making the same mistakes. If your life has been on things and you've forgotten the personal, isn't it time to turn it around? To do the will of God, to become the person you can be in His service? Would you start while we sing?